Chapter 9. The next morning, every road in D.C. was jammed from 5:30 a.m. onward. More than 100 Hayden long-range truckers got onto the interstate loop around the city and arranged their trucks in geometrical patterns designed to induce maximum disruption to automatic driving systems and drove at 25 miles an hour. Commuters, frustrated with the loop being more locked up than usual, switched over to manual and tried to get around the blockages, which, of course, only made things worse. By 7 o'clock, the loop was at a complete standstill. And then, for extra added fun, Hayden truckers locked up Interstate 66 and the toll road into Virginia. "Late on your third day of your job," Van said to me from her desk as I got into the office. She pointed to the desk next to hers as she did it, indicating that it was my desk now. "Everyone's late today," I said. "I should be graded on that curve." "How did you manage to get in from Potomac Falls anyway?" Van asked. "Tell me you borrowed your dad's helicopter. That would be kind of amazing." "As it happens, Dad does have a helicopter," I said, "or his company does. But it's not allowed to land in our neighborhood. So, no, I got dropped off at the Sterling stop of the Metro and took the train in." "And how was that?" "Unpleasant," I said. "It was super crowded and I got a lot of nasty looks. Like, it was my fault the roads were crushed. I almost said, 'Look, people, if it were my fault, I wouldn't be on the goddamn train with the rest of you now, would I?'" "It's going to be a long week with this shit," Van said. "It's not an effective protest if it's not pissing people off." "I didn't say it wasn't effective," Van said. "I didn't even say I wasn't sympathetic. It just means it's going to be a long week. Now, come on, forensics has got news for us." "What news?" I asked. "On our dead guy," Van said. "We know who he is. And apparently there's something else, too." "First off," Ramon Diaz said, "meet John Sonny, your no longer mystery man." We were back in the imaging suite, looking at a highly detailed, larger-than-life image of Sonny on the morgue slab. It was cleaner and less annoying to the medical examiners to have field agents look at their handiwork this way. The model Diaz was projecting could be manipulated to examine any part of the body that the examiners scanned or opened. At this point, the body did not look as if it had been cut into any more than it already had been at the neck. This was the cover scan. "So the Navajo came through for us," Van said. "They did," Diaz said. "Looks like they sent his information to us around midnight their time last night." "Who is he?" I asked. "As far as the information we have tells us, he's not anyone," Diaz said. "The Navajo Nation have him on file for a single drunken disorderly when he was 19. No time, community service. Other than that, what we've got is his birth certificate and social security, a few medical records, and his high school transcripts, which run through 10th grade." "How'd he do?" Van asked. "The fact it stops at the 10th grade might tell you something." "No driver's license or other sort of ID?" I asked. "No," Diaz said. "What else?" Van asked. "He's 31 and was in less than great health," Diaz said. "Some liver damage and heart disease and signs of incipient diabetes, which is not too surprising in someone with a Native American background. Missing a few teeth in the back. Also, that slash in his neck is consistent with a self-inflicted wound. He did it to himself, and he did it with that broken glass you found." "Is this everything?" I asked. Diaz smiled. "No, it's not. I have something for you that I think you're going to find really interesting." "Cut the suspense, Diaz," Van said. "Get to it." "They did an X-ray of his skull before they took out his brain," Diaz said. He popped up the three-dimensional scan on Sonny's head. "Tell me what you see." "Holy shit," I said immediately. "Huh," Van said after a second. The X-ray of Sonny's head showed a network of thin tendrils and coils in and around the brain, converging on 5 junctions distributed radially around the interior surface of the skull, the junctions themselves linked to each other in a mesh of connections. It was an artificial neural network designed to send and receive information from the brain, displayed in almost perfect detail. 2 groups of people had structures like these. I belonged to one of those groups. Van belonged to the other. "This dude's an integrator," I said. "What's his brain structure?" Van asked Diaz. "The report says it's consistent with someone who contracted Hayden's," Diaz said. "And that's consistent with his medical records, which show he had meningitis as a kid, which could mean the Hayden's variety. He's got the brain structure to be an integrator. Shane, Van said, still looking at the x-ray. Yeah? I said. Problems with this scenario, Van said. I thought about it for a minute. This guy didn't get through high school, I said, finally. So? Van said. So, integrator training is a postgraduate thing, I said. You undertake it after getting a suitable undergraduate degree like psychology. What's yours? Biology, Van said. American University. Right, I said. Plus, there's supposed to be a raft of psychological and aptitude tests you have to clear before they let you into the program. It's one of the reasons there's so few integrators. Yes, Van said. It's expensive, too, the training process. Not for the student, Van said. The NIH covers the costs. They must have been pissed at you when you left, I said. They got their money's worth from me, Van said. Bring it back around. Okay. So the question here is, here is a guy who didn't finish high school and who we have no record of anywhere outside of the Navajo Nation, which means he didn't have integrator training. I pointed to the x-ray. So how does this guy get all that wiring in his head? That's a good question, Van said. It's not the only question. What else is wrong about this picture? What isn't wrong about this picture? I asked. I meant specifically. Why would an integrator want to integrate with another integrator? I asked. More specific than that. I don't know how to get more specific than that, I said. Why would an integrator want to integrate with another integrator and bring a headset? Van asked. I looked at her blankly for a couple of seconds. Then, oh shit, the headset. Right, Van said. That reminds me, Diaz said to me. I got inside that headset like you asked to see if there was any useful information on those processor chips. Was there? I asked. No, Diaz said. There were no chips inside the headset. If there are no chips inside, then it wouldn't work. It's a dummy headset, I said. That would be my thinking, yes, Diaz said. I turned to Van. Seriously, what the hell is going on here? I said. What do you mean? Van asked. I mean, what the hell is going on here? We've got two integrators, one of whom shouldn't be an integrator, and a dummy headset. It doesn't make any sense. Van turned to Diaz. Fingerprints on the headset? Yes, he said. They match Sonny, not Bell. So Sonny brought the headset to the party, not Bell, Van said, then looked back at me. What does that suggest to you? Maybe that Bell didn't know Sonny was an integrator, I said, and that Sonny didn't want him to know he was one either. Right, Van said. Okay, but again, why? I asked. What possible use is there for Sonny to convince Bell that he's just a tourist? Without the headset, he can't even be that. Unless there's some integrator-to-integrator ability I don't know about. No, Van said. There's a sort of neural feedback loop that happens when you try to put one integrator into the head of another. You can fry people's brains that way. Like scanners? I asked. Like what? An old movie about psychics. They could make your head blow up. Van smiled. Nothing that outwardly dramatic. But inwardly, it's not supposed to be pleasant. It's blocked at the network level in any event. So it couldn't have been that, I said. Plus the whole suicide thing again. Van was quiet again. Then, what time is it in Arizona? It's 2 hours behind here, so about 8:30, I said. Maybe? Arizona's weird about time zones. You need to go out there today and talk to some people, Van said. Me? Yes, you, Van said. You can get there in 10 seconds for nothing. There's the small fact I will have no body, I said. You're not the only Hayden on the FBI staff, Van said. The Bureau keeps spare threeps at the major field offices. Phoenix will have room for you. It won't be fancy, she motioned to my threep, but it will get the job done. Are the Navajo going to cooperate with us? I asked. If we let them know we're trying to figure out the death of one of their own, they might come around, Van said. I have a friend in the Phoenix office. Let's see if he can make things easier. Let's get you out there by 10 their time. I can't just call, I asked. You need to tell some family their son or dad is dead and then ask them a bunch of personal questions, Van said. Yeah, no, you can't just call. It'll be my first trip to Arizona, I said. Hope you like hot, Van said. At 10:05, I found myself in the Phoenix FBI field office looking at a bald man. "Agent Beresford?" I asked. "Damn, that's creepy," the man said. "This threep's been in the corner for 3 years without moving, and suddenly it gets up. It's like a statue coming to life." "Surprise," I said. "I mean, we've been using it as a hat rack. Sorry to deprive you of your office furniture. It's only for the day. You Shane?"
"That's right."
"Tom Beresford." He held out his hand. I took it. "I don't mind telling you I've never forgiven your dad for crushing the Suns in 4. "Oh, that," I said. He was talking about Dad's second NBA title. "If it means anything, he always said that series was closer than it looked." "It's nice of him to lie like that," Beresford said. "Come on, I'll take you down to meet Claw." I started walking and stopped. "Jesus," I said, and started jerking my leg. "Something wrong?" Beresford stopped and waited on me. "You weren't kidding when you said this thing didn't move," I said. "I think something's rusted up in this thing." "I can get you a can of WD-40 if you want." "Nice," I said. "Just give me a second." I fired up the Threak's diagnostic system to find out what was going on. "Great, it's a Metro Courier." "Is that a problem?" Beresford asked. "The Metro Courier is like the Ford Pinto of Threeps." "We could try to find you a rental Threep if you want," Beresford said. "I think Enterprise might have some at the airport. It'll just take forever and you'll spend your day filling out requisition forms." "It'll be fine," I said. The diagnostic said there was nothing wrong with the Threep, which may have meant there was something wrong with the diagnostic. "I'll walk it out." "Come on then." Beresford started off again. I followed, limping. "Agent Chris Shane, Officer Claw Redhouse," Beresford said after we reached the lobby, introducing me to a young man in a uniform. "Claw went to Northern Arizona with my son. As it happens, he was in Phoenix on tribal business, so you got lucky. It would be a 285-mile walk to Window Rock otherwise." "Officer Redhouse," I said, and held out my hand. He took it and smiled. "Don't meet a lot of Haydens," he said. "Never met one who was an FBI agent before." "A first time for everything," I said. "You're limping," he said. "Childhood injury," I said. And then, after a second, "That was a joke." "I got that," he said. "Come on, I'm parked right outside." "Be right there," I said, and then turned to Beresford. "There's a possibility that I might need this Threep for a while." "It's just collecting dust with us," Beresford said. "So it won't be a problem if I keep it in Window Rock for a while," I asked. "That's going to be up to the folks up there," Beresford said. "Our official policy is to defer to their sovereignty, so if they want you away when you're done, head to our office in Flagstaff. I'll let them know you might be on the way. Or get a hotel room. Maybe someone will rent you a broom closet and a plug." "Is this a problem?" I asked. "I'm not really versed in the relations between the FBI and the Navajo." "We don't have any problems at the moment," Beresford said. "We've cooperated with them just fine recently, and they have Claw taking you up, which says they don't have a problem with you. But other than that, who knows? The U.S. government gave the Navajo and a lot of the other Native American nations a whole lot more autonomy a couple of decades back when it downsized the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service. But that's also given us an excuse to ignore them and their problems." "Ah," I said. "Hell, Shane, you might be able to sympathize," Beresford said. "The U.S. government just pulled the plug on the Haydens, didn't it? It's something you folks might say you have in common with the Navajo." "I'm not entirely sure I want to be going around making that comparison," I said. "That's probably wise," Beresford said. "The Navajo have a 200-year head start in the getting screwed by the U.S. government category. They might not appreciate you jumping on the train. But now you might understand why some of them might decide to be touchy about you showing up and asking questions. So be polite, be respectful, and go if they tell you to go." "Got it." "Good," Beresford said. "Now go on. Claw's good people. Don't keep him waiting."